Welcome to Leaders Live. Good to have you along. I'm David Cushnan. Here is Cameron McDonald, and this is the monthly sports business chat show from Leaders.
That's right. We're here again at IMG Studios in London. We're live on Twitter and LinkedIn, or you might be listening into the podcast. Get in touch live with questions and comments at Leaders Biz on Twitter and on the Leaders in Sport LinkedIn page. Or if you're old-fashioned, email us at studio@leadersinsport.com.
I am old-fashioned. On Leaders Live today, we've got not one, but two types of football.
Yes, that's right. Coming up in a second, Brett Gosper, who's the NFL's top man in Europe, will be speaking to us about the success of this year's international series, as well as the league's global expansion. A little bit later on, as Qatar's World Cup draws to a close, we'll be discussing the future of the World Cup as a tournament, as a platform, and as a product.
We'll be joined by a panel who've been at the heart of some of the big decisions about where the World Cup is staged and what it looks like. We will have with us John Zarafa, one of the architects of Qatar's bid for the World Cup and now the founder of Clear Thought Communications.
Also on the show, Nick Varley, founder of LookUp Communications and another veteran of major event bids, including London 2012, and EDI consultant, Edeline John. All that to come a little later.
But first, the NFL season is in full swing, with attention soon to turn to the playoffs and the big game itself, Super Bowl 57 in Arizona. The NFL's been playing games in the UK since 2007, but its 2022 international schedule was its most ambitious yet, with games in London, Mexico, and for the first time, in Germany.
That's right. And with a selection of teams now able to commercialise in international markets and an increasing focus on both league promotion and talent identification around the world, it's a perfect time to take the NFL's global pulse with Brett Gosper, the league's head of Europe. And Brett Gosper joins us now. Hi, Brett. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Just going to start off with a bit of a scene setter about this year's international series. Can you give us your reflections on how that's gone, what that debrief looks like for you now?
Yeah, it's been a very successful season for us in this part of the world, in Europe, as well as the game back being back in Mexico at the Azteca Stadium. But we had three games in London, two games at Tottenham Stadium, one at Wembley. They all broke new ground in different ways. We sold more tickets for Tottenham than we've sold before. In terms of attendance, we had a record attendance at Wembley as well, with over 86,000 people there. And of course, we broke completely new ground in Germany with that first ever regular season game in Germany, which had 800,000 people in the ticketing queue, so we knew it was going to be a sellout.
Right.
I don't think Ticketmaster had ever seen anything quite like it. And on the day, an amazing, fantastic atmosphere in Germany, in the Bayern Munich Stadium, the Allianz Stadium, the home of Bayern Munich. So it really was, very successful. And it set us up for another great season next year.
And that debrief process, what's that looking for you right now?
Yeah, look, it's all about over the period, how does that recruit new fans? How does that build our revenue base in Europe? How does it engage governments, local government and hosts in stadia in a way that they want to keep hosting those games in those markets? How is it rating on television ratings? How is the engagement across social media? I mean, there are so many different KPIs that we look at to see if it's successful, and certainly in all of those KPIs, the games this season, they were helped by the fact that the winning margins, or the losing margins, depending on which team you're supporting, were never greater than 5 points in the games across Europe. And the game in Mexico being a little bit larger in margin, but the European games were very tight, held their audience all the way, and gave the fans a huge satisfaction that were at those games. We also had the fairy tale in Germany with Tom Brady playing and winning and being player of the match and so on. And I think as a talisman for the sport in that market for the first game, it was such a huge bonus for us.
So let's dig into that Germany game and the Germany experience. I think the NFL does an enormous amount of due diligence. I think the industry recognises that the NFL is absolutely renowned for that. And you will have pored over an enormous amount of data when you were looking at taking games to Germany. There was a host city selection process involved as well. You talked about the demand for tickets and the interest levels generated from the game in Germany. Was that surprising? What was your response to that?
Yeah, look, we've always known it's a huge market, and it's grown very rapidly in recent years. There's been an underpinning by the fact that it was the hotbed of American football during the 90s and the early 2000s, so on with European leagues. But we were surprised ultimately at the ticket demand, and the queue of 800,000 people was extraordinary. But there are 17 million casual fans in Germany versus 15 million in the UK. They both line up with about 3 million avid fans in each market. So the German market has a lot of potential to grow that avid fan base even more. And that's what we've seen as the effect of this initial game.
Let's talk a little bit about you, Brett, because you've been in the role at the NFL for nearly 2 years.
Just on two.
Yeah, yeah. Nearly approaching that exciting LinkedIn anniversary. And of course, you moved from a role at World Rugby, where you're in charge of that organisation. Very different type of organisation. Obviously, a membership of nations, of national governing bodies. The NFL, obviously, reporting into the league office in the US, but looking after the international side of that. 2 years in, how different are those two organisations? And have there been things that you have been able to take from your World Rugby experience to plug into the NFL?
Yeah, look, they're very different organisations. Comparing a governing body with a professional league is difficult in itself because they have very different motivations and objectives, although there is quite a bit of overlap. I think in some ways the NFL behaves internationally like a governing body because it's developing the sport, it's developing flag football, it's interested in being in the Olympics. So it has the power to engage with a broad number of markets and so on. So it feels a little bit like an international federation too. At the same time, it's a highly focused commercial organisation with high net worth owners in for the most part that are really focused on growing the fan base and the revenues of the sport over time. World Rugby is a political animal. You can be mired in factions and politics and the commercial side of it is secondary. It's more about participation than commercial fandom in a way. So there are some differences, but I think the similarities are also is certainly outside of the United States, NFL is a challenger sport. So I feel comfortable in that mode because rugby in every country, probably with the exception of Fiji and New Zealand, rugby is also a challenger sport. And some of the challenges around the physicality of the sport, the complication of the sport, the stops and starts, how do you develop the sport and getting balls into kids' hands and so on. There are a lot of similarities in that sense as well.
And as you manage up and manage down, leadership style, is your own personal leadership style evolving? Has it changed dramatically?
I think, I'm not sure it's changed. That'd be for others to judge. I think in any way, in any role like this, you've got to bring a lot of people with you. It's a big organisation, the NFL. I mean, World Rugby was complex by the number of countries you were dealing with. It wasn't a corporate relationship. This is a corporate relationship. There are a couple of thousand people at the NFL. It's a multi-billion dollar organisation annually. Our television rights alone are $11 billion annually. So it's a big corporation versus a big network of countries and political interests. So, again, some similarities, variations on a theme, I'd call it.
I'm quite keen to latch onto something you said there about sort of being a challenger sport and sort of the lessons learned there from obviously rugby being a challenger sport, because it's strange to think of, you know, the NFL as a challenger league or a challenger sport, being that it's the most valuable and the most watched league in the US. How does that differ? What have been the challenges in sort of perhaps in differing to something like a rugby, which is a challenger everywhere, to taking a dominant sport in one region and taking that worldwide?
Yeah, I guess the difference is you've got an impatient leadership in New York. When I say impatient, they're used to operating as a dominant leader in their own market. So when they're talking about subjects and movement and evolution outside, they're looking for very quick and substantial results because that's how what they're used to dealing with in the United States. I mean, it is totally dominant in the States. I mean, in the last 20 years, 75 of the top 100 programs on US television have been NFL games. The second most watched sport is actually college football in terms of viewing audiences on broadcast and so on. So it is incredibly dominant as a sport. We see that in the reflection of television rights and so on. It's highly successful. And then that success is expected to be mirrored rapidly and significantly in other markets. So it's navigating that cultural expectation in the United States with the realities in a growth market. And I think there's a good understanding in New York, but just occasionally there is an impatience or a lack of understanding why things aren't as easy to manage and run, and the NFL can't just walk in and expect things the way they do in the United States.
High expectations indeed.
Yeah. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about I guess another challenge that you face in terms of the growth of the NFL as a brand, as a league, but also working with the franchises on an individual basis to grow outside of the US. And we've seen quite a long process again in terms of the NFL getting to a stage where it's able to grant rights in certain territories to certain teams. Just explain, we're nearly a year into, or a year since that announcement was certainly made public. How are you charting progress that teams are making in general? Sure. And how does that work when you have a league-wide operation to think about?
I mean, it's early days in that project. I mean, I think it's an acknowledgement by ownership that international is a priority, and it certainly is in the conversation. I've just flown in this morning from Dallas, and we were presenting a lot of the international material yesterday, and there's high interest and high hopes for the growth in international, and they're not just hopes. People want us to plan very solidly for it. They know the next 50 million NFL fans are not going to be coming from the United States, they're going to be coming from international. So the what they call the international home market area program was devised to allow teams to commercialize and market in foreign territories, but they had to apply for those marketing rights through the league office to show they're actually going to exercise those rights in a way that would help grow the sport. And the theory is casual fans tend to be fans of the NFL, avid fans tend to be fans of a club and players and so on. So actually enabling these clubs to activate in foreign markets increases the avidity of our fan base, which is where the revenue lies. We think in year one, it's probably doubled the marketing noise of us in our core markets, in our seven core markets outside of the United States. And so we're seeing that already as a success. There's 19 clubs of the 32. There's a new round of clubs that'll apply in March. And we know there's a lot of interest to join that group of clubs that are activating. We've got six clubs activating in the United Kingdom, four in Germany, nine in Mexico, two in Australia, one in Africa. I mean, I could go on like that. But the whole point is they can bring players in, they can run events, they can market their brand, their players like it, the brands themselves are benefiting from it, and the league is benefiting from the cacophony of noise that is created from a marketing sense.
It's worth saying that, as you mentioned, you're fresh off the plane from Dallas, Brett, and may I say, looking absolutely sensational on it. You were in a series of meetings over there. I mean, how does it work practically from your point of view? As obviously we've come through the COVID period.
Sure.
You're based in London. League office is based in New York, but actually, you've got the franchises and the franchise owners in particular, who are obviously dotted across the US. How much face time do you get with the league office and with those owners, and how does that work?
Yeah, look, the league office constantly. There is a person in charge of international that I report into in the States. He's kind of the door opener to all of the different corridors in the NFL for us, and a key person in driving the totality of international, but also providing access to those areas that certainly someone who was new in needed that help in the beginning. And gradually, over time, you create your own relationships and things happen well. In terms of ownership, there's, around four meetings a year, two major meetings with ownership and so on, where we go in and present and questions are asked and so on. There are committee meetings with owners, the international committee, chaired by Joel Glazer, who is from the family that owns Man United and so on. It's quite a bit of overlap between some of the, obviously, the Premier League ownership and NFL. So these different committees operate, and we have that interface with ownership there more constantly. And then the wider group, as we had yesterday in Dallas with, the 31 owners plus the representative of the 32nd team, which is Green Bay, which is owned by the fans.
To the best of your knowledge, is there an NFL owners WhatsApp group? It'd be a good one to be in, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I'm certainly not in it.
All right.
That's all right.
I'm quite keen to hear about, we've talked about a lot of different aspects of internationalising the NFL, and certainly, you were just mentioning there, teams in different regions. Where, in your opinion, are players coming into this? There's been a lot said about foreign-born players playing in US leagues, yeah, popularising games internationally, notably in the NBA, for example, with players like Giannis or Luka Doncic. How important to the NFL's overall global strategy is something like the international players' pathway?
It is very important. We know that if there are foreign-born players or players with a good, strong foreign linkage, then that spikes interest in those markets where those players come from. And it is part of the international program to find that talent in those markets and give them an opportunity either at an early stage through our NFL Academy, which is based in the UK, to provide opportunities into American colleges and then onto the NFL, or in our International Player Pathway program to actually identify players at a later stage that can go straight into a situation where they might be on either a draft or on a practice list with some of the clubs. So finding those players and then them actually succeeding does create huge uplift in interest in those markets. So there are currently through last weekend, there was 86 foreign-born players that had actually had one snap during the season so far. There's around 106 total throughout the league and so on. We have a day also during the International Games Week where players can put another flag other than the American flag on their helmets to show that their country of origin or where they have a special relationship. That's not just foreign-born players, but those who have either been brought up in another country, lived a long time in another country, or have parents from another country. And there's about 240 of those. So The international linkage is something that is increasingly a preoccupation, either through the academy or through the international player pathway.
Let's do a relatively, and I do mean relatively, Brett, quickfire round. Just be good to get a few of your thoughts on the following. And the first would be around, I guess, the next markets that you're looking at. From an international perspective, obviously a lot of work going on in Germany. You've got the UK. Mexico has been a sort of another established international venue for the NFL. There's been some recent personnel moves, particularly in Australia. But where are you thinking about, and what sort of top of mind at the moment?
Yeah, we're looking at a number of markets. Obviously, we're consolidating and continuing to grow where the potential is, which is UK and Germany and Europe. Certainly the next two markets that are getting our attention are Spain and France in particular. Spain has two of those clubs operating, commercialising in that market. And France, obviously, a large sports market with high television rights and a very strong potential in that market. And both of those markets on a good time zone in Europe. When you go outside of Europe, it's much harder, a heavier lift because of the time zone factor. Live sport is king. And when you're moving outside of natural viewing time zone hours, it becomes a little bit more difficult. But we have a good uptick in Australia in terms of fans, in terms of broadcast rights, consumer products, streaming service on Game Pass and so on. So we have a presence now in Australia, and that's important to us. And we're also working hard to develop the African market and looking at some alternatives there and how we can accelerate that, both as a source of talent, but also over time, as a country where we can establish ourselves in a brand and marketing sense.
Quickish fire question number two.
My answers aren't quickish fire enough.
No, they're good. They're good though. That's important. Is the most tiresome question, and you do a fair bit of media, is the most tiresome question that you are asked about when London will get an NFL franchise?
It is. It's not tiresome because it's a good question to ask, because I think the more it's asked, the more we have to answer that. And there are more and more conversations happening, I think, both with ownership and the league office on where that might be and how that might be. And look, there's nothing imminent. It's what I usually say, there's nothing imminent happening. But there is certainly, a drumbeat of conversation around the topic. And I think we saw the commissioner alluding to this when he was here during the international games, and a lot of it got a bit of headline around, two teams in Germany, two teams in the United Kingdom. I think the point he was making is the demand is here, the stadia are here, and the media is interested enough for that to be possible. And I think also when he talked about those numbers, it's probably easier to have a division in Europe than just one team, which has all sorts of issues around equity of competition and so on, which is more complex. So all of these things are being evaluated and assessed over the coming period, and that's not a short period. There are a lot of hoops and obstacles. It's complex, but it's very much in the current conversations, I'd say.
Well, thank you for indulging me, as I found a slightly different way, hopefully, of asking exactly that question. Cam, you are a big flag football guy, aren't you?
Big flag football guy, and I'm definitely interested in this sort of idea of seeing flag football included at the Olympics, and certainly it was included at the World Games in Alabama back in 2022. How important is that as sort of increasing the global reach of the NFL and football as a sport and seeing it in these international tournaments?
Look, it's really important. I think there's been a realisation of that, even in the time I've been here, how important flag is, that it really is a great converter of fans at a very early age. So you get lifetime value of your fan as they move into that pipeline much earlier, and flag plays a role at the youth level for that, for girls and boys in schools, in clubs, etc. And so we've put a lot of focus on that, and there's a shifting investment level which is increasing in that area. And certainly we see the Olympics as a very strong driver of that possible growth of that sport outside of the United States in particular. It's very strong already. There's about 20 million flag players around the world. 15 million of those are in the United States, as you can imagine. But it is growing. There's 100,000 new flag players in Mexico last year. It's a hugely popular sport in China as well and other parts of the world. Of course, in the core NFL markets, it's also a high growth sport. So the Olympics would be, I think, a great driver of growth in that area. And the connection between the NFL and flag is strong, and therefore that connection would be healthy for us. We also think the NFL has a lot to bring to the Olympic movement, particularly if it was Los Angeles, where we have obviously a strong connection with a fan base, which is could be theirs as well. And we think there's lots of alignment in the two brands. We obviously sit with IFAF, which is the governing body. IFAF is driving this inclusion, and we're you know, behind them and helping them and partnering with them to in the hope that we would be included in the 2028 Olympics in Los Angeles, but nothing certain, of course.
One to keep an eye out for in 2028, then. One final question for you, Brett.
Earlier, hopefully, we'll know, but, you know.
Yeah, fingers crossed. One final question for you, Brett. We've talked a lot about, you know, sport all over the world, taking games all over the place. You're obviously a very well-travelled man yourself throughout your career. What, in your opinion, is the greatest sporting destination in the world?
I mean, it depends what you mean by a destination. I mean, if you mean which event, which place...
Your interpretation.
I'm not sure that there is one. There are some cities that tend to get a greater share of some of the big events, and I think certainly London would be up there in that sense. Is it the greatest sports destination? It depends on the stadium. It depends often on the weather. It depends on access for fans around the world. I know in Australia, Melbourne claim the title of one of the most sporting cities in the world. There are cities in America that do that too. I think it depends on the event, the sport, and the spirit of the fans who turn up on the day to see those events. And fortunately, there are many, many contenders around. This is a real sit-on-the-fence answer. There are many cities around the world now that could lay a claim to being the ideal sporting environment for whatever major sport event they might host. The Japanese, right up there too. Look at Rugby World Cup. Look what they did during the Olympics, unfortunately, during COVID time. But there are many, many cities and countries that could lay claim to that, I think.
A model answer in many ways for the man working to take NFL games to many cities around the world. Brett Gosper, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, in the 12 years since Qatar was awarded the 2022 FIFA World Cup, the tournament, the when, the why, the how, has loomed over almost every part of the global sports industry. And so it feels a little strange to be at the end of the competition itself, but it is a moment to consider what happens next. Indeed, this tournament marks the end of an era, or at least a decade, of mega events, World Cups and Olympics in new and unfamiliar surroundings. Russia had its phase in 2014 at Sochi and with the 2018 World Cup. So did Brazil, host in 2014 and then the stage for the first Olympic Games in South America, Rio 2016. And then there was Qatar, as unlikely a host for a World Cup as there has ever been. A controversial one, certainly, but also a uniquely formatted tournament. All eight stadiums spread over just 50 kilometres in and around Doha. Seasonally as well, for Northern Hemisphere viewers, the first Winter World Cup. And there are ongoing questions, as the spotlight has shone on Qatar, about the World Cup's impact and ability to accelerate the pace of change in infrastructure, developed at enormous financial and human cost, and in changing attitudes. FIFA president Gianni Infantino, who inherited this World Cup, will argue that his organisation and the tournament has been responsible for improvement on all counts, and that much of the criticism stems from inbuilt and long-standing Western media bias. But separating the politics and the football has been impossible. From the geopolitics of the region to the bravery of the Iranian team's silent anthem protest and the dispute over what armband to wear, when and for what. It's worth considering here the scope and scale of FIFA. In a complex world, it's trying all it can to retain a position of neutrality wherever possible. And remember, it is responsible for over 200 member nations of every kind of size, influence and maturity. But treading that diplomatic and cultural tightrope at the same time as being financier, protector, administrator, media distributor and digital game changer for the most popular game in the world seems increasingly out of kilter with the rest of commercialised, commoditised professional sport. Might there be a new way? In a football business where clubs, regional governing bodies like UEFA, national football associations, private equity firms and whole states, not to mention players, have serious stakes, a slice of power and growing influence, what's the future for a global membership organisation? Whispers that some FIFA member associations are in the early stages of considering breaking away are, for the moment at least, just that. But they are whispers worth noting. For now, the FIFA and Qatar story is coming to an end, and the heavy glare will shortly move on from the smallest nation ever to hold a World Cup. The next decade of mega events looks, on paper at least, a little less stressful. The Olympics are heading to Paris, then Los Angeles via a winter stop in Milan Cortina, France, the US and Italy, all established major event hosts. There are and will be a new set of challenges there. The World Cup, meanwhile, is heading for North America. 32 years after FIFA took its biggest tournament to the United States, the US will co-host again, this time alongside Canada and Mexico, a united bid for a competition that will be expanding from 32 to 48 teams. FIFA's rationale is clear: more opportunities for more nations to get a ticket to sport's best party. But 48 teams complicates what has been, in recent editions of the World Cup, a near-perfect 32-team format. Commercially, it feels as if there's little to stop the US, Canada and Mexico 26 from being an enormous success. But be it format, purpose or platform, there's plenty more than money to consider for FIFA and for the football family it likes to talk about so much as the World Cup evolves and moves into its next phase of growth.
Thanks, David. And let's delve into a few of those points now with our guests, here to provide their observations and perspectives on the future of the World Cup as both a product and as a platform. We're delighted to be joined by John Zarafa, founder of Clear Thought Communications, who worked on Qatar's original bid for the World Cup back in 2009-10, as well as many other major event bids around the world. And by Nick Varley, founder of Lookup Communications, who also worked on London's successful bid for the 2012 Olympics, as well as a variety of other major event bids.
And on the line live from Cardiff, Wales, delighted to say we're joined by Edleen John, equality, diversity and inclusion expert and consultant. Welcome to you all. Hopefully I managed to set things up there. There's a lot to get through and we do welcome your questions and comments, of course. Do post them on Twitter and LinkedIn. John, want to come to you first. As mentioned, you were involved in the original bid to stage the World Cup, which must seem an absolute lifetime ago now. And even then, the concept and the planning around the legacy of this tournament for Qatar and beyond Qatar was something that was being discussed. Take us back to when you were in the rooms discussing how all that might come together.
Thanks, David. Good to be here. It does feel like a long time ago, I have to say. If you track it back to the very early 2000s, I think, back in 2008, Qatar unveiled its 2030 national vision. And this was its plan to move away from hydrocarbons to a more balanced economy. And now, within that document was a large plank of sort of sport ambition that was around hosting major events and building sporting infrastructure. So I think that was sort of the catalyst for sort of wider ambitions in hosting 2022. Why that's relevant is that it's not just an ambition to host 2022 in isolation, but it cut across, you know, links to establishing Doha as a major international travel hub, It links to Qatar's ambition to launch Be In Sport, become an international broadcast partner for sport. It links to, you know, the creation of major stadia and sporting infrastructure as well. So it shouldn't be seen in isolation. It should be seen as a move to a carbon neutral, more diversified economy.
It's funny though, you talked about obviously the long-term goals there, Mission 2030, obviously big in the sort of long-term plans for Qatar. How do you see the after effects of a World Cup impacting a nation like Qatar as compared to a sort of a more established, I suppose you could say, traditionally footballing nation? Is it sort of better to go in with sort of an established history in that area, or is it maybe better to have a blank slate, as you might say, that Qatar had going into it?
Well, I mean, from a comms and bid perspective, it's great to have a blank slate, you know, because the thing with the Qatar bid, and obviously there's been a lot of history and a lot written and said about it, you know, it was historic. It's the first Arab World Cup. It's obviously, as David said in the intro, the smallest, most compact host of any World Cup in history. A big part of the narrative during the campaign was around developing a new market in football across the Arab region, both commercially but also in terms of football development. When it was meant to be hosted in the summer period, there was a whole story around innovative cooling technology that could be shared with the rest of the world. So there was quite a historic, groundbreaking, innovative narrative that underpinned that bid. And I think actually part of that has and will be delivered. I mean, if you look at the legacies from Qatar in this tournament, you know, every stadium is dismountable. The shipping container stadium will be completely dismantled and shipped to somewhere, I'm guessing somewhere in Africa or Asia. A lot of seats will be redistributed. And I understand there's been a lot of interest from various football associations across the world. And I think also, you know, just having a Northern Hemisphere winter tournament, I actually think that's probably the biggest legacy of Qatar 2022, because it shows that if there's a will, there's a way to do things differently. Now, I'm not saying this will become the norm every or every other tournament, but if we look at climate change, you know, we look at Spain just this summer hit 48 degrees. Mm. Is it conceivable or feasible that in the next 10 to 20 years, you know, tournaments can be played in June or July as heat increases? And if you do want to take the Olympic Games or the World Cups to the Arab world again, you're going to have to think about the calendar. So I think for me, the biggest legacy of Qatar will probably be that blueprint that you can change the window.
Nick, like John, you're, am I allowed to use the word veteran? Of the sports bidding and hosting and sports communications game, and it's really good to have you with us as well. And you've worked on a lot of these bids, and you've won some, and you haven't won some. What are some of the key considerations for would-be host nations, particularly of mega events as we would describe them, World Cups, Olympics, and do you see those considerations changing as the world changes around us?
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you for inviting me on, and thank you for calling me a veteran. Yes, true. I'm so much of a veteran that I remember the day that England 2018 lost to Qatar and Russia back in Zurich in 2010, which was a decision that was surprising, shall we say. But I think the question you ask about what bidders want from it has changed over the last 10 years, because what you've seen with Qatar is an incredibly small and incredibly wealthy country put down a marker for how you can be as ambitious as you possibly want to be. And that changes the dynamic for lots of other countries that don't have the wealth or don't have the political systems that allow, you know, quick decision-making and senior-level decision-making. So you end up with a very different field of runners and riders. If you go back 10 years, back to the London 2012 Olympic bid, for example, which John and I both worked on, the runners and riders were broadly the same. They were Western European democracies or Russia, which was, you know, presenting itself as a democracy at the time. These days, you look at the runners and riders for the 2036 Olympics or the 2030 FIFA World Cup, and they vary from very rich oil gas states to ambitious emerging markets to tradition European places, and all of those different venues have different reasons for doing this.
Edlina, I would like to bring you in. Good to have you with us. You consult many organisations on their EDI strategies, EDI policies. Latterly worked at the Football Association. And one of the big talking points, really, of this World Cup over the last few weeks, as the attention has really focused on Qatar, has been the use of events like the World Cup as a platform for advocating for change or for protest. I just wonder, as you reflect on what you've seen over the last 4 or 5 weeks, has it changed your view in any way of how these major events can be used in that way?
I think I'm really clear on the fact that football, and indeed any sport, is a huge platform for change, because there are viewers at home, people supporting, people engaging in the match because of their personal preferences, and therefore they can become engaged in debates and topics about EDI issues. But I think it's really important and really critical to recognise that the starting point has got to be that actually no country that is going to host a World Cup, or indeed any other sporting event, is perfect. And I think one of the interesting things that I really noticed with Qatar is we had a significant focus on a number of issues, be that workers' rights, be that LGBTQ plus issues, be that women's rights. And it's important to bring these topics to the forefront to create that awareness. But my key position is that awareness has got to lead to subsequent change. And I know that football and other sports have had protests, be that, you know, wearing an armband, be that being silent during an anthem, be that kind of making a gesture. And my key element is, whilst that's important for a moment because it brings that awareness and highlights the key issue, I'm not yet convinced that those gestures lead to the type of change that we want to see within each specific country or within each specific region. And for me, that's where the focus needs to lie. And that's where I think football and the broader sports ecosystem really needs to put their money where their mouth is.
I think, Edlina, we're increasingly seeing, you know, activism from, you know, individuals or sort of smaller sort of subgroups, whether that's sort of players or teams or FAs, you know, in the case of this. When you're looking at sort of the big overarching organisations, how can a sort of global governing body like a FIFA or like the IOC sort of operate in the best way to remain neutral? And should they continue to remain neutral in a, you know, an increasingly you know, politicised world?
It's a really difficult line to kind of toe, exactly as you mentioned in the kind of intro. You know, FIFA has over 200 member associations, each of which will have different positions as it relates to equality, diversity and inclusion issues, will have different legislation, different religious and cultural backgrounds. And actually, we need to be cognizant of the fact that each and every one of those members is important and is valuable and should be treated equally. And that means, of course, they need to have a voice as it relates to what it is that they want FIFA to be doing and what the expectation is as it relates to FIFA. I feel as though I can say this because I am from the West. I feel like often with the West and with the Western media, we have a view that our position or our take has got to be the strongest and has got to be the loudest, because many of these sports maybe have been developed within our countries, or we have a larger platform commercially for the sports within our countries. But I can understand that from a FIFA perspective, there has got to be some balance. Now, do I think that they should be taking positions or having views and perspectives? Absolutely, because they can help really increase that awareness and increase the topic and increase the debate. And also, let's be clear, these commercial organisations hold the purse strings. So there is a weight that can be placed on the financial investment and the financial support. However, that view needs to be balanced, and it's not one where we come in and we have an overtly westernised perspective on the way in which we think something should be done in another country, just in the same way that we wouldn't want that to happen if a tournament was being hosted, you know, here on UK soil or here in England. So I think it's about opening the topics up for discussion and creating a platform for debate and for different perspectives to be heard, being respectful of people, prioritising, of course, human rights and environmental rights, which are two key elements of everything that we're doing in the day-to-day world of sport and in society more broadly. But it has to be recognised that it's a different position to take to land on the side of one FA versus another, or of one country versus another, particularly when there is no one country that we can point to and say they're perfect.
John, Nick, let's bring you in on that. This idea of the World Cup as a platform and what that looks like in the future, and building on what Edlina was saying there, for a FIFA, for an IOC in the case of the Olympics, how How careful do those organisations have to be in terms of treading a line here when it comes to having a line on any number of topics in amongst huge media noise, as Edeline correctly pointed out, all sorts of different stakeholder groups to try and manage and bring with them on the journey? Where do you even begin with something like that?
It is a difficult balance. But one of the interesting things that we're going to see with the World Cup from 26 onwards is that FIFA, for the first time, has put into the hosting agreements specific requirements around human rights and labour rights. And that's the first time that that would have happened. So it's very difficult if FIFA does that, which it's right that it has done that, it's very difficult then for it to be politically neutral. So in a way, I think we're now on a particular journey where FIFA has potentially got to be even more politicised. But Edeline is absolutely right. When you've got 211 member associations, they're all on a different life journey of development. You know, some of these nations are relatively new. They've inherited laws from previous, you know, rulers, shall I say. And the pace of change is different. And I think it's incumbent upon organisations like FIFA and the IOC to encourage positive change. So I think we're going to see more of that.
And I think there's two really significant underlying factors that are feeding into this. I totally agree with Edeline's, you know, both FIFA and the IOC, in fact, the world of sport is historically Eurocentric, Western European, whether it's taking sports to other places or administrating sports. The two trends at the moment that are very pronounced and that both FIFA and the IOC have to challenge and to work around are the fact that the world is becoming less Eurocentric and there is a significant shift to other places, notably we see it with Qatar. But then secondly, you have activist athletes, and all of a sudden the athletes who in the old days were, you know, told what their job was and where their place was have platforms sometimes of millions of people who they can connect with directly, and they have the opportunity to make their voice heard. You know, what you saw in Qatar with the England team and the armbands was a disconnect between a governing body trying to keep its host country happy and an FA trying to represent its team. And that is the kind of intersection of views that you're going to have more and more of over the years, I think.
Nick, I want to stick with you, but I want to take the conversation back a step and talk about sort of the host perspective again and sort of, you know, use the advantage of some of your expertise to sort of have a look at where the real opportunities are here. You've won a bid. You're the host nation for a major sporting event, be it a World Cup, be it an Olympics. What, in your view, is the sort of big missed opportunity? Where are host nations leaving money or opportunity on the table?
I think it's the same as it has been for a long time, which is legacy. And I think, you know, if your ambition is to win one of these events because you like to do it for soft power and nation building, well, you need to have a plan that builds upon that. If your plan is to do it and build a new city or a new stadium or a new infrastructure, you have to have a very long-term plan in order to do that. And I think the most interesting thing for me, slightly away from football, out of Qatar, is they're already beginning to brief that the Olympics is their next ambition. Mm. And you can certainly see, well, this makes sense, talking to John's point about the infrastructure they've put in, the number of stadiums they've built. You don't build that many stadiums in a country that size to hold one tournament and then forget about it. There is a long-term vision at play here, and it would not surprise me at all if you see the first Arab Olympics in Qatar at some point in the future.
I mean, just to add, Cameron and David, you know, that legacy is already in play with a certain number of key events already due to take place. We've got the Asian Cup in 2023 in Qatar, maybe pushed to 2024. We've got the Asian Games in 2030. If I were a betting man, I wouldn't discount the potential of an Arab Super League developing over the next 5 to 10 years.
Wow.
You know, that could include Saudi, Qatar, go into North Africa. And I think possibly FIFA would be quite supportive of that development. And obviously that brings in a whole new revenue stream and development stream for the game of football and for FIFA.
Edeline, wanted to bring you in on the point around, I suppose, developing the ground rules, the parameters around bidding for these major events. From the rights holding side of things, the, you know, the organisations that are awarding these events to different countries, different places, that's a key part of their business, placing their product in, you know, for whatever reason, the right place. From a from an EDI point of view, from a point of view around issues like human rights, for example, do you think what we're missing at the moment is almost a sense of agility in the rule book, in the policy development around major events and how they are planned for and executed?
I think, as has already been said, that there is some progress in the fact that we're actually going to be having bids evaluated by looking at human rights and sustainability as key metrics for whether a country is kind of right to host. So let's recognise and acknowledge that is some progress. But I think we have to absolutely understand the need for agility around what that is going to mean within different communities and within different parts of the world. And I think actually that's where FIFA's next challenge will lie, because what human rights might mean in one part of the world will be somewhat different to what it means somewhere else by virtue of, as we've said, what we as the West might see as antiquated rules or antiquated legislation, or actually the way in which we believe that individuals should be treated. And you know, I, of course, have personally strong views about that, but I recognise that that is why the voting perspective and getting multiple views to input on that is going to be critical and important. And why I suppose, you know, bodies like the FIFA Council are made up of representatives from different parts of the world. So it's not just one perspective that overrides another. I think if we are going to continue to see that development and see tournaments awarded in a similar way where this becomes a key component, then absolutely FIFA is going to need to be agile about what that means, what it's clear on, what its perspective is, and how that is going to change and adapt to different parts of the world. But we need to then also recognise that from a media perspective and a broader societal perspective, we need to approach that dissonance or disagreement as it relates to human rights with the same ferocity and the same vim as we have done as it relates to Qatar, because for me that's where actually bias can come in, and you can see certain worldviews being kind of put on top of others, and that's not something that I think any of us want to see in the world of sport. I think, again, as we talked about, players, ex-players, legends also have a voice, and I'm sure we'll continue to use that voice as it relates to future tournament bids and their perspectives. But I think it's about us all being willing to understand, adapt, change and learn about different cultures and communities, and, you know, recognise that actually that can bring some growth and development to the broader game.
2026, as David mentioned, will see us go to the US, Mexico and Canada for the next edition of the World Cup. And I'm quite keen to hear all of your thoughts. I'm sure you have different views and maybe some overlapping opinions on this idea of a multi-host bid for these major tournaments. Obviously, we've had them in the past with World Cups. The most recent Euros was sort of multi-hosted. What are some of the opportunities? What are some of the big challenges? Fan of it? Not a fan of it? I'm going to start with you, John.
It's going to be different to Qatar, isn't it? You know, you've got a 50-kilometre host city at the moment, host country, and you're going to three different large countries with 5-6 hours travel time. You know, from a team and fan perspective, there's logistical challenges. You know, from round to round, you could potentially be looking at 3-5 hour, you know, travel distances to move to your next base camp and team training camp. There's operational challenges about meshing, you know, the Americans, the Canadians and the Mexicans within a management structure. But 26, I think, will be the first FIFA World Cup where FIFA, it's a proper joint venture between FIFA and the host countries. So FIFA will be even more engaged in the management and running of that tournament than ever before. Commercially, I think it's going to be successful. I should say on Qatar, though, the four-year cycle up to 2022, their revenues are up 30%. So from a commercial perspective, you know, Qatar has worked for FIFA in terms of bucks. And I think that trend should continue going into 2026.
And more games, of course, as well in 2026 with the expanded tournament. Nick, you're a multi-host guy?
You have to be, because the reality is that with the 48-team FIFA tournament, you are going to have multi-host every time. There is not a country in the world that can host a 48 tournament on its own. So enjoy Qatar as a small, compact one-off. But 26 is going to be the new model. If you look at the bidders...
And actually, just, sorry, 2030, if you look the way at 2030, that's shaping up,
all
that
of
becomes
them.
Even more disparate in terms of where those countries are based.
Every single country that is bidding for 2030 is a consortium of I think 4 to 5 countries, 3 to 5 countries. Yeah, at one point, the English FA were working with Ireland, Scotland, Wales, all three of us were working on it at one point for a World Cup bid for England, Wales and Scotland, Ireland for 2030. Which again, you know, there's no way any one of those countries, not England, not especially the smaller home nations, could host the World Cup anymore at 48 teams. And I think that's going to be true of the Euros increasingly, which is also talking of becoming a bigger tournament. So from a fan perspective and from a logistical perspective and all the things John mentioned, yes, it's going to become more difficult, but there is no way you can do it on your own anymore.
I mean, two little things to add. If I was Spain, Portugal, I'd reach across the Gibraltar Strait to Morocco. Yep. Invite them to join their 2030 bid.
Previous bidders, of course.
Previous bidders. Actually, I worked on the Moroccan 26 bid. You know, that would be a very strong, compelling bid, not least because it's 10 miles across the strait from Gibraltar. You'd bring in Arab votes. You'd bring in African votes. So from a vote-winning perspective, it makes real sense. Same time zone. And Morocco is a fantastic country. And a little quick reflection on England and the World Cup. I think unless we were to partner with a non-UK partner, you can forget hosting the World Cup in the foreseeable future. I don't know whether Ed Dean's got a view on that, but that would be my view.
I want to take that to Ed Lean and the idea of sort of a non-UK partner, because it does raise a question. What's the realistic limit on this? And we've seen already for 2030 a lot of these, you know, combinations that you might not automatically, you know, put together. There's about 3,000 miles between Vancouver and Mexico City.
I saw you on Google Maps the other day doing your work.
Looking away. Yeah. More or less the same distance, London and New York. Could a transatlantic World Cup work? Is that something that's feasible?
Look, I think that the challenge that has been mentioned before is the kind of logistics and operational elements that come in when you're working cross-country and cross-borders. I think you've also got to be mindful of the fact that different FAs and different countries will have slightly different priorities. And exactly as has been said, that sometimes does become difficult when you're working as a group and there are different priorities in the mix. That being said, I absolutely agree with what has been said by Nick and John in terms of, I think that is the direction of travel moving forward. I think it will be, you know, cross-border bids with different countries bringing different positive elements to the table. But I think as long as the game and fans and fan enjoyment is kept at the heart of it, then for me that can only be positive. And I think, you know, crossing those borders does enable different associations, you know, whether that's countries in different parts of the world or countries that maybe haven't worked that closely together before, to come together and to host something that I think is powerful. I don't see how that can be a negative thing if that's the direction of travel moving forward, because it also gives more countries the opportunity to play host in a way that we haven't seen historically. And the tournaments can move around the world in a more positive way. And I think that's great.
Well, we should remember also that next year, Women's World Cup, which we obviously haven't talked about, is not just cross-border, but it's cross-confederation. So it's both Asia and Oceania coming together in Australia and New Zealand. So that was groundbreaking as well. So we really are looking at, I think, a step change in the FIFA world in terms of multiple countries, cross-confederation. And I think one of the interesting dynamics going forward is, what does the IOC do about its own hosting model going forwards? And is it going to be as innovative as FIFA has been in terms of hosting?
So I'll come back to that. Your point about the 3,000 miles, from a real geeky point of view, 3,000 miles across the globe versus 3,000 miles up and down the globe is very different, because you are in the same time zone. So Canada and Mexico are actually more or less in the same time zone. And so
it's all gone a bit geography lesson.
I know. Right? So
I've been scuppered by logistics. Not for the first time, I've been scuppered by the logistics.
I'll move on to the IOC question. Well, the IOC, I think it's the winter bid from Sweden, had a suggestion that it would be co-hosted with only one venue in Latvia, if I remember rightly. So there's no doubt that the co-hosting country thing, it's more applicable to football because you need bigger stadiums and it's a different style of event. But I'm sure that the IOC are looking at different options for hosting because it's just the smart thing to do.
We're rapidly coming to the end of the show, but I do just want to ask one more question and would ask you for as quick an answer as possible on this. And that's the one thing, the non-negotiable thing that you think the World Cup and World Cup organisers have to get right. What would you say that is? And Ed Lean, we'll come to you first.
So for me, it would be a legacy in terms of support for human rights in each and every country. As I said, it's not just an issue in Qatar. We have modern slavery in the UK. We have people being killed by law enforcement in the US. Wherever you go, there is a human rights issue. And so for me, it's if we are going to take a political stance on these points, then actually, once we all pack up and leave Qatar and move on and start focusing on the next World Cup, what have we done to support the people actually living in country whose lives continue after the tournament has ended? And I think that's where football needs to invest some time, some thought and some real life energy, as opposed to just focusing on gesture politics.
John?
Without being too pithy and simplistic, just run the tournament really well, seamless, make players happy, make the fans happy. We've seen that with Qatar. A lot of the criticism pre-tournament has slightly dissipated, partly because the attention has moved to the football.
Nick, final word?
I'm going to go even shorter. I think you need a vision. I think that's what you've always needed, a vision of why you're doing the tournament and what it's going to lead to afterwards. But I think increasingly these days you also have to have a purpose that is changing the world a little bit.
Adeline, Nick, John, great to have you with us. We await future developments with interest. And thanks too to Brett Gosper for joining us earlier.
That's it from Leaders Live this month and indeed for this year. If you are getting a break on behalf of the whole Leaders team and the IMG team, hope it is a restful one. We will be back in January the 12th to be exact, with your ultimate guide to the trends to watch in 2023. Until then, bye-bye for now.